Dr. R.J. Rushduni, RR-161C6, Colloquy in Reconstruction Economics. From the Easy Chair, excellent colloquies on various subjects.
This is R.J. Rushduni, Easy Chair number 50, Tuesday, August the 2nd, 1983. Today it's our privilege to have a very good friend of Chalcedon here, John Stafford. John has a very varied background and a most interesting one. As of yesterday, he finished his work with the Department of Interior, and I'm going to ask John to describe something of his work there, something of his background. He's been in the military, in investment, in quite a few things. John, it's good to have you here.
Thank you, Rush. It's really beautiful here in Vallecito. Well, with the department, I was director of the Office of Hearings and Appeals. I came about a year ago, and when I was getting comfortably ensconced in Florida, but had decided to take off a year's sabbatical and go to seminary. And I actually turned the job down a couple of times until I found out I could go to seminary at night at Dominion Theological Institute in McLean, Virginia. It's based at McLean Presbyterian Church. So I did welcome the opportunity to come up and work in the Reagan administration and work for Jim Watt, who's just a fabulous fellow and, as you know, a staunch Christian. And the job I had was in the office of the secretary. I had a staff of 125 people, of which 42 were administrative judges and administrative law judges, about 20 attorneys, and then a number of support people. And basically what we did in that office was to make decisions for the secretary that he didn't have time to make. Most of them were of the important and then a lot of routine decisions, whereas the secretary himself is concerned with the more urgent and politically tinged decisions. I believe we did upwards of 4,000 or more a year, and it's a pretty fine office, and I was actually quite pleased with the high quality of the professional bureaucrats that I had working for me. But of course, as is true with any bureaucratic organization, be it in the public sector or the private sector, there were some problems and some institutional barriers which we tried to overcome, and it's quite a frustrating fight, but I like to think we did fight the good fight and hopefully accomplish some small modicum of good.
I understand to improve efficiency, you were trying to make some very extensive cuts that would have saved the taxpayers some money, but you ran into a bit of trouble there. Do you want to tell us about it?
Well, there probably isn't a justification for more than about 75 or 80 people in this office, where there are actually 125 budgeted. But there's just no way that with the civil service regulations being what they are and the political realities internal to the department and external, that would really allow you to do that. So I was pleased to have tried to save about $1 million out of a little over $5 million budget, and actually returning to the department $400,000 outright, and by taking some other actions, avoided spending another $300,000 or $400,000. So, you know, we fought as good a fight as we could, and I guess the frustrating part is that you're just not really free to have the kind of management control that you normally would have in the private sector and really should have in the government sector.
Ann Burford remarked that it is illegal for someone to return budgeted money. And this poses a further problem, does it not?
Well, I didn't have that particular problem because Jim Watt is so smart using the budget to drive his policy. And so what we didn't use, he could reprogram to do the things that he's trying to do there within the department. But in terms of turning it back to the Congress, I don't know whether it's illegal or not, but I'm sure that the vast majority of the people in Washington would be against doing anything like that. And I just was further sensitized, I guess, not so much shocked or amazed, but further sensitized to the, you might call it the fantasy reality of Washington, that the people there do live in a fantasy world. They seem to think that, or believe that, money does grow on trees, that there's a cornucopia of an under increasing amounts of money, and it's just their obligation to spend it, and they don't think of it in terms of being the taxpayers' money or individual citizens having to dig in their pockets and forego various things in their lives that they would like to have to come up with the tax revenues to support these programs. They just think of it in terms of, well, the money is there, and there's more going to be more, and it's up to us to spend it. So they're interested in spending, and their whole orientation is towards spending, and they don't have the feeling that this is money which in any way is held in trust or that should be handled very carefully because it is other people's money. They consider it to be their money.
Let me throw in something here parenthetically. Before going to Washington, John published an investment letter which was the most expensive one in the country and had a very select clientele. And John is knowledgeable in this field. John, I think our people would be very interested if you told us something about the economics of the drug industry today as it affects the monetary situation of this country.
Right. I don't hold myself out really as an expert in anything. I consider myself a student of a number of different things, and one of which is the area of money and monetary policy. And to do that, you have to be familiar with the banking system and how the Federal Reserve operates. And, of course, one of the things that drives interest rates is what the Federal Reserve is doing with the money supply, or particularly not so much M1, M2, et cetera, M through M15, which, by the way, have been growing at astronomical rates, contrary to everything that you hear from the official spokesman of the Federal Reserve over the last 2 years, really since late October of 1981. And one of the things that I look at very carefully for guidance on the economic and financial markets is net free or borrowed reserves. In other words, how liquid is the banking system? And if you have, for instance, $6 billion in net borrowed reserves, that's generally associated with very high interest rates. And we did have that 2 or 3 years ago where the banks were in a net borrowed position of about $6 billion, and that was associated with a prime rate of upwards of 20%. Recently, the prime rate has dropped down closer to 11.5 or 12, and in some places even 10, 10.5. And this coincides with a net free position in the banks' banking system of about, I think they got somewhere around $200 or $300 million in the plus side. So the liquidity of the banking system is a very important thing. Well, where does liquidity come from? It comes from a lot of different sources, but one of which is deposits which are placed with individual commercial banks, which, by the way, I don't think really are in the free enterprise system. They really have become, because of excessive regulation and mutuality of interest interlock with the government, arms of the government. So I look of them at them the same way as I would any government agency, not as a private institution. even though they still pose as private institutions. In any event, I guess a sort of a hard way of saying it would be that whether they know this or not, or whether they want to be or not, the people in the federal government have a vested interest in the continuance of the drug trade, because so much money is being raised through that enterprise, illegal enterprise, and placed in the banking system on deposit with the various banks. This is particularly true. I saw some statistics about 2 years ago when I was down in Florida, and we're very sensitive to the drug problem down there, which showed that there were so many tens of billions of dollars being put on deposit with the so-called commercial banks in Florida that there was a huge surplus of something like $3 billion in free reserves in the Federal Reserve Southeast District. And that was primarily due to the fact that huge amounts of money were being laundered through banks in Florida. The result of that was that instead of the entire U.S. banking system was being liquefied by the existence of this money in this one particular district. So that one way to say it, I guess, would be that if this were not true, we might perhaps have had 25 or 30% prime rate rather than a terrible 20% prime rate back 2 or 3 years ago, had it not been for the existence of this drug money. And that probably would have either brought down the banking system or have had an even greater negative impact, and it probably would have produced a much more severe recession than the one that we actually had. So we've gotten ourselves, I guess the way to look at this, in a terrible box. We're caught between a rock and a hard place, which is what I was talking about in my September 7th, 1981 letter in particular, and that we really don't have too much room to maneuver.
So we're very dependent economically upon the drug trade.
Yes. Sad as that may be.
Yes. Which means that to endanger that drug trade would be to endanger the banking system and the economy generally.
Right. That's a reality. It's an unpleasant reality. It's one that a lot of people wouldn't admit to, but the way I see it, it's a fact, just as the fact that the greedy and incompetent bankers and the, I call them the nine brothers, who for years have been in bed with his seven sisters, the big banks in New York and elsewhere, Chicago and here on the West Coast, that these bankers, through greed and incompetence and stupidity, have lent out all this money to the third world, and therefore the administration is placed in the position of going to the Congress and asking for $8.5 billion in additional contributions to the International Monetary Fund, because they say if we don't, the whole system might start coming apart.
Which it would.
Well, it may or it may not. I don't think that it necessarily would, because I think that if you removed greedy and stupid and incompetent businessmen who were being subsidized in many ways by the government, from the economy, that this would allow entrepreneurs and people who are smarter and better to do the same job, if that job did need to be done, at lower cost, and that would have a beneficial effect on the economy, even though the immediate effect for a few weeks or a few months might appear to be negative. But sometimes the best thing, as a matter of fact, I think most of the time, the best thing to do is to bite the bullet.
Yes.
And do the right thing, regardless of what appear to be the short-term consequences. So I think that either some of these people are just unknowledgeable about past economic history, or have frightened themselves, or are deliberately frightening, trying to frighten everyone else into thinking that this is the only way that we can go, when in fact, I believe that if we did the right thing, and especially if we trusted in the Lord, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 is my favorite scripture verse, that if he saw us doing the right thing, he would take care of us.
Yes. That's what I hoped you would say, John. Well, you know, there's an old proverb that birds of a feather flock together. So you've got the federal government, the third world countries, and the drug dealers in bed together economically.
It's sad to say it's true.
Mm-hmm. And the one who's paying the price is the good citizen who still goes on paying his taxes.
Exactly.
Because we're having, how extensive is the sub rosa in economy that is avoiding taxes, that is underground in one form or another? Do you want to discuss that?
Well, briefly, I'm not really an expert in this area. I just have read about it over the last few years. I was in Europe a number of years ago, and I know that at that time this was sort of the norm. And so, as I understand it, our situation is sort of retarded time-wise vis-a-vis Europe. I understand that upwards of 50 or 60% of the Italian economy takes place in the underground, upwards of 40 to 50% of the French economy, and I have seen some statistics ranging anywhere from 15 to 25% of GNP in the United States takes place in the so-called underground economy. I would think that the important thing is to recognize the trend and the direction that this is going, rather than, you know, arguing over what exactly the percentage is today. I don't think that's particularly important. But I do see this growing, because as the government becomes more and more lawless, and we have more and more of what we have had the last 50 years in particular, a government of men, not laws, that more and more people will, at least as Francis Schaeffer has pointed out in the Christian Manifesto and many of his talks, have the development, the continuation of the passive revolt generally against government. And hopefully we'll be smart enough, and with the Lord's help, to take effective action soon to do the right thing, so that we don't go all the way down that path toward active revolt. I think that that would have terribly negative consequences, and I think just as the Civil War was an unnecessary war, that that would be unnecessary to have violence in this country in terms of active revolt. So if we have the guts to face up to the realities and of the situation in all of these different areas, and then once having done that, say, okay, let's take intelligent and effective action to deal with where we've gotten ourselves, that I have great faith in the common sense and integrity of the American people, and I see lots of good signs. Actually, I've been accused over the years of being a doom and gloomer, but that's not true. I'm a perennial optimist. It's just that I'm also a realist, so I tell people quite openly what I see the truth to be, the reality to be, and encourage them to do the right thing. And as in my own life, it sometimes takes years to be willing to face up to something, and maybe even a further number of years to build up the guts to actually take effective action. So in that sense, I'm patient, because I've had to learn that in my own life. But I think that's really the key. And again, in the long run, we're talking about prayer and trusting in the Lord. In the short run, I think there are a number of things that we could do, which would be not only good, effective action, but also send a signal that we were putting on the armor, as Ephesians 6 is talking about, and preparing for the battle. And one thing that on that point that is going on right now, I think, is very important, is to stop the IMF funding bill in the House. And I see where the administration and the leadership of the House are scrambling around now trying to see how to get that bill through the House, because they found that there is substantial opposition to the point, hopefully, of a majority against it. And anything that your subscribers can do, or the good citizens of the United States can do, to stop this monstrosity and rip-off of the American taxpayer, I think would be very beneficial, not only in terms of the actual event itself, but also in terms of the signal that it would send that we're making a major shift in the right direction.
The thing that is interesting to me is, of course, all over the country, further funding of the IMF and of the third world countries is very unpopular. But I did not expect Congress to react negatively to it. So I think your suggestion that those who listen express their feelings strongly on this issue is a very good one, because it will spell the death of the dollar ultimately, and its damage to our future will be very, very great. You did, yes.
On that point, there are a couple of other angles which aren't even being discussed in terms of this IMF bailout. One of which is that it's not only a threat to the sovereignty of the countries which are being bailed out, but it's also a threat to the sovereignty of the United States and its continuance, if we still are one, as a constitutional republic. And I say this in light even of a letter to the Wall Street Journal from a gentleman in Guatemala who is begging the people to do what we've just suggested here in the United States, because he didn't want the people of Guatemala and the government of Guatemala to become more dependent on the IMF.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a direct threat to their own sovereignty and independence. And to the extent that the IMF does become de facto, if not de jure, a world central bank, that's a threat to the sovereignty of the United States as well. So, you know, it's not just an economic and financial event. It's also an extremely important political event, going to the very question of really imperialism, if you want to talk
mm-hmm.
about that. And, you know, who is running the show, whether it's the people of each country who can maintain their own diversity and uniqueness of their system, or whether it's going to be some group of self-alleged, self-appointed elitists who are going to try to tell everybody else what to do
mm-hmm.
according to their humanistic plan.
You cited as a text for our time certain verses in Proverbs. Do you want to comment on those verses?
Well, I know they've been extremely important in my own life. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, as I remember it from, I think, the NIV, says, trust in the Lord, lean not on your own understanding, walk in His ways, and He will make your paths straight. So you can even look at that in four parts, even though, of course, it's completely connected together. The first part, trust in the Lord, again, I'm a fairly new Christian of just about 3 years, even though I was raised Roman Catholic and I think got a very fine education for the better part of 20 years through the Catholic schools. But then I lapsed, fell away for many years, and just 3 years ago last June, I got right with God, as Dr. Kennedy down at Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church likes to put it. And without going into my testimony, this particular verse was very important to me. And in 1980, I had a tremendous lesson for a year in this area of trust. And then my seminary studies have shown me in my Genesis and Ephesians class and John class in particular that that really is the underlying basis for the relationship between God and man, and really the theme of the Old and New Covenant. Trusting in the Lord. And if you look at the great patriarchs of the Old Testament in particular, they were men who trusted in the Lord. Abraham with his son Isaac and the sacrifice or potential sacrifice. Noah, who went on building this stupid ark on dry land for 100 years or so. Job. In each case, these men did what God said because they believed God, and in every case there were tremendous blessings. And of course the contrasts were, you know, Adam and right down the line, where they turned away from what God said and did what they thought was best, and of course that always leads to evil and chaos. And I think it's really perhaps the underlying difficulty in all of human history, that we try to not do what God says. We try to shove him out of the picture and put ourselves up and try to do what we think is best. And that, I think, is the main reason that we have this chaos and disaster and lack of peace and brotherhood and understanding that so many people complain about. Doing what God says we should do, and I know your ministry has been very much geared to this, and many of the books that you've written, the Institutes and others, have really stressed this point, Rush, that just do with God what God says and trust him to take care of the rest. And I've always had a high view of the sovereignty of God, and the more I learn, the higher and higher it gets. And fortunately, the more humble I get, and to see that God really does have total control, and our job is to get our pride and ego out of the way so he can do his work. As my old pappy used to say, yours is not to question why, yours is but to do or die.
Your father was in the military, wasn't he?
Yes, he's a retired Marine colonel, as is my uncle, and also my cousin just got back from 9 months in Beirut, was promoted to lieutenant colonel and given 3 years in London with his family, which I think is a pretty decent thing to do, consider the tough action that he had to deal with in Beirut.
And you yourself have been in the military.
Yes, I have a long career. Matter of fact, I was in 3 different branches of the service, if you include my Air Force ROTC at Maryland, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marine Corps. And we lived on an Army base as well when my dad was CEO of the Marine Barracks that guards the National Security Agency. I can't understand why everybody's getting so worked up about the National Security Agency, because, you know, I've known about them for 20 or more years. But I am retired from the Marine Corps Reserve with 21 years longevity, even though I don't have the 20 years necessary for a pension. At the time that I retired, I was engaged to a woman with 4 children and had my business going, and I, on the one hand, on the temporal level, didn't feel that I wanted to be called back to serve, as many of the men were after World War II, for Korea, to really interrupt my life just at the time it was about ready to hopefully get planted and stable. And also I felt, and I was a vice chairman of the Reagan Finance Committee during the 1980 campaign, that one of the best reasons for electing Reagan over Carter was that either under Reagan or Carter, we may well go to war, but at least under Reagan, we had a chance to win. And but at the time, this was January of, December of 79, and January of 80 when I retired, all the polls showed Carter winning. And so I just didn't want to serve under Carter in an active duty military role. So there were a number of reasons, but I did put in my 21 years, plus I felt that really I had another 18 or so as a Marine Corps junior, as they call them, in the family. So I figured I'd put in the better part of 39 or 40 years, and that was fine. Mm-hmm. I still go to the Congressional Marines breakfasts and so forth and so on, and the 8th and I parades, and keep my hand in with Marine Corps activities, the Marine Corps ball every year in November, but I've basically done my service. But I think I did learn a lot, not only from my father, but from my Marine Corps training, about preparing for battle and defending what you think is important in life. And I'm finding that without consciously thinking about it, a lot of these principles I'm able to apply in Christian work and in the financial field. I know there was a book which I just bought another copy of recently by Gerald Loeb. It came out during the 50s, and I guess it was passed around, given by Merrill Lynch to its customers in the 60s. It was called the battle for investment survival. And I think really that concept applies in many areas of our life. Nutrition, I think Adele Davis really makes this point about good nutrition. You're in a battle for good health. In the financial world, you're certainly in a battle. And as Paul tells us in Ephesians 6 in particular and elsewhere, we're in a battle as far as our spiritual life is concerned. So many different areas in which these concepts of, which some people might label as pure military, really have much wider application.
Mm-hmm. You also went to law school somewhere along the line.
Oh, yes, I slipped that in. I never really wanted to be a lawyer, but I figured law school was a good place to learn. I really wanted to go to Notre Dame and take theology and philosophy, and I had given serious consideration to the priesthood over the years, especially when I was Blessed Sacrament school in Washington, D.C., Chevy Chase Circle back in the 50s, and then at St. Anselm's Abbey School, taught by the good Benedictine fathers in the 50s. But then I had discovered girls, and as I went to these CYO dances, I realized I could never be a priest. Yes, it's true that that I did end up at law school at the University of Washington. And as I was telling you the other day, I'm thinking about suing them for educational malpractice, because the year that I got there, they brought in a fellow who was from the Eastern Ivy League genre, or of that genre, and I think that was the year they eliminated Blackstone and brought in HLA, Hart, Sachs, and all these secular humanist types, legal positivists. And I knew they were doing something to my mind, but at the time I didn't have the tools to know exactly what it was all about, so I was at a great disadvantage. Over the years, the Lord has helped me, you know, work through that, and I think I'm finally falling in with a good crowd here among the Christian Reconstructionists. But I know you've got some ideas or plans relating to helping people like me. Had your work been available and I had known about it 20-some-odd years ago when I started law school.
You know, if you'd gone to Notre Dame Law School, you would have gotten both theology and law.
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I would have gotten a combination.
Which, of course, is the necessary combination, and that's why we're in trouble today. Because theology and law have been separated.
Right.
And theology and life have been separated. Mm-hmm. It's been made an abstract subject, unrelated to the everyday world.
Exactly, which has got to lead to total disaster, as this professor Paul Kurtz and I were discussing the other day at the Institute on Religion and Democracy meeting. And it was actually a fairly gentle interplay, but I kept asking him why he would do things the hard way and eliminate a great source of help, to wit, God, from his daily activity. You know, why not invite him in to help? And I guess it goes back to that same old thing that befell Satan and befell Adam, that our own pride just keeps us from a willingness to do that.
Yes, those of you who are listening who don't know who Paul Kurtz is, he's head of the Humanist Association of the United States. And as John and I were discussing last night, these humanists believe in the greater miracles when they believe in evolution. That's the greatest miracle anybody
right.
ever imagined.
Exactly.
And it's a myth.
It's a myth. And we've just been systematically deceived and still are being about evolution. And, you know, something that's really bad that's part and parcel of that is the disingenuousness of the people who are involved. They're not really telling the truth. The fact is that the theory of evolution is no more than a theory, and perhaps not even an hypothesis. Whereas if you watch public television, either Cosmos or any of these other series,
yes.
the one on Darwin or the one they had just this past winter, they talk about it as established fact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really crazy, because from what I can tell, there has never been any proof of any missing links between a change of species. And I have come around to the view after sort of going along for so many years with the evolutionists, because I never really took the time to think about it specifically for myself. I'm taking the view now that I'm going to believe the Bible for so long as no one can prove it wrong. And that's my starting point. And so far, I don't see anything that proves Scripture wrong on, let's say, the creation. And in fact, what I have been learning, and I was just at a Philadelphia Bible College two or three weeks ago for a seminar put on by the Institute for Creation Research, and that is that if anything, especially archaeology, is proving up the Bible. We're finding out that the prophecies that were made hundreds of years in advance, even 1,000 or more years in advance, say about the destruction of particular cities, are being found out to be absolutely uncannily accurate by the scientists who are doing the digging.
Now that as of today you're a free man as far as Washington, D.C. is concerned, I understand you are planning to write a book.
True. I do want to finish in the month of August my seminary studies at Dominion Theological Institute. I've been taking a full load of four courses for this summer semester, and then next fall I'm currently planning to go up to Grove City College and work for a doctorate probably in Christianity and Civilization. Hans Senholz has been after me about doing an economics for a couple of years. Mostly it's an opportunity to, again, take a sabbatical and do a lot of the reading that I would like to do. But I do have seven book titles of books that I would like to write, and one of which I've actually put some time and effort into to establish an outline and actually fill it out in a few places, and that book would be called The Age of Irresponsibility. And so in lieu of a standard thesis, they've suggested that I write a book, and I think that would be the book that I probably would write, because I think that, at least in the temporal sense, if not more, might be the underlying theme of the modern age, and particularly this century. Almost a total lack of responsibility on the part of we as human beings in so many different areas of life. I'm reminded of the comic strip Pogo, and where Pogo, of course, is quoted the famous phrase, "We have met the enemy and he is us."
Yes.
And I think we've become our own enemies because we have failed to be responsible. And again, I appreciate the work that you're doing, because you're showing people the scriptural and theological basis for how to be responsible, and then going beyond that and saying, let's actually do it, rather than just talking about that as an abstract concept, which, we couldn't possibly implement in the modern age.
Mm-hmm.
We can and we must.
Yes. Well, you know, irresponsibility is a product of the fall of original sin.
Mm-hmm.
We're told in Genesis that when man sought to be his own God, determining good and evil for himself, his immediate reaction when confronted with his sin was irresponsibility. Adam told God, "The woman thou gavest to me to be with me, it's your fault. You gave her to me. She did give me and I did eat." So it's God's fault and the woman's fault.
Yes.
And the Eve said, "The serpent did give me. Poor innocent thing that I am, how was I to know? I was deluded. The serpent did give me and I did eat." Both were irresponsible. And the deeper a society gets into sin, the deeper its sense of irresponsibility. So here we have an irresponsible world. We're in an irresponsible age. You know, in two or three of my books, including a forthcoming one on salvation and godly rule, I deal with the will to fiction that is so much a mark of our age.
Right.
We've never had an age that has saturated itself more in the world of its imagination. through novels and through television, through films. We live in a dream world. More marriages are broken, I believe, by imagination than by reality.
Absolutely.
I picked up something that summed it up very well, the spousal gap, or spouse gap. And it said something I had encountered over and over again. One of the problems in so many marriages, reason for discontent, for adultery, and other things, is the ghostly lover. That is, the imaginary person they want. And the real man and the real woman never meet their expectation.
Exactly.
People face the world with this irresponsible imagination, and the world never meets it, and they run more deeply into their imagination, so that we are par excellence an age of irresponsibility. I think that's an excellent subject to deal with.
Well, thank you. I think you actually had a book out that, since I bought so many of them but haven't had a chance to read them all yet, Flight from Humanity.
Yes.
And maybe you could come out with one that is entitled A Flight from Reality.
Good subject. Hmm. Maybe sometime I will. I have a book that I finished a few years ago, and we haven't had the funding to publish it yet, entitled The Death of Meaning.
Yes, right.
You see, our world, by abandoning God, has abandoned meaning. What I do is to trace how this has happened in philosophy,
mm-hmm.
with its implications for everyday life.
Yes.
And with the death of meaning, responsibility no longer has any meaning.
Exactly.
So
why bother to be responsible if it doesn't matter?
Yes. And when you have a belief that every man is his own God, and that's what every person outside of Christ believes, that he is his own God.
Right.
And Sartre said that his problem was not God, it was his neighbor.
Yes.
Because if he was God, then his neighbor had to be the devil.
Yeah, scapegoating again.
Yes. So everybody withdraws from themselves. And I think it's in this forthcoming book I describe hell as a place of total isolation. Mm-hmm. No one talks to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Each one is his own world.
And that's in stark contrast to the fellowship of the Trinity and why the Trinity is so
yes.
important.
Right. Total communion.
Right.
And our goal, total communion with the triune God and with one another. And Sartre, you know, wrote something about hell entitled No Exit.
Ah, oh, yes.
It's a play. And all these people are sitting around in hell. They are talking to themselves. They wonder if the door is locked and if they can open it and go out, but all they do is talk to themselves. No one does anything. No one tries the door. No one communicates. They're talking at each other, but they're only talking to themselves.
Well, it's interesting. I haven't really thought this through, but even though I'm a Christian, I'm a fan of the Eagles rock group, and they have a...
We'll forgive you.
Okay, they have a song called Hotel California, and being here in California, I've been thinking about this. There is a verse in there, I think at the end, it says, they go to the night clerk, and he says, you can check out, but you can never leave.
Yes, very good.
At the Hotel California.
Well,
going back to this concept of irresponsibility, I wasn't even aware of it, but apparently it's been brought to my attention. There's a book out which connects irresponsibility with mental illness and says really
yes.
that the root of mental illness is irresponsibility.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another way of saying it.
Exactly. What we call mental illness is irresponsibility and an attempt to escape from reality, because it doesn't meet your hopes.
Mm-hmm.
So you run away from facts. You run away into the recesses of your own mind and try to escape those things that you don't want to solve. And of course, people are doing that without going into mental illness. They're doing it by getting wrapped up in any number of activities and things which have as their function escapism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, fiction, TV, films, rock music, couldn't avoid getting that in.
I only listen to the Eagles once every 2 months.
Well, since you confessed, you're forgiven.
Right. Well, I think that's absolutely true. I guess this is one of the reasons I've been somewhat of a square peg in a round hole in my life, because I've just never been that interested in any of those things that you mentioned, especially fiction. I just have not been a reader of fiction. Just about everything I put my hands on is historical or nonfiction. And maybe there's too much of imbalance in that direction, but still, that's the way I've been oriented.
Well, fiction can be a confrontation with reality, but as fiction is developed, it's anti-Christian, an anti-reality, therefore. So modern fiction is very evil in that respect. Now, a work of a novel like Crime and Punishment is a tremendous confrontation with reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because here you have a student in Crime and Punishment who is an unbeliever, who believes that the idea that God has given man a conscience and that man is inescapably accountable to God, all this is fiction. He kills an old woman. His belief is her life is worth no more than that of a louse or a flea. Technically, he believes it's meaningless. Actually, if anything, it's a plus. He's eliminated someone worthless from society. But his conscience bothers him.
Hmm.
And that's the thing that horrifies him. His conscience bothers him. And he cannot take the fact that he feels guilty.
Hmm.
He has an encounter with a girl, Sonia, a prostitute, who's been driven into prostitution by the poverty of her family. She knows she's a sinner. And by that awareness, she is stronger than he is.
Hmm.
Well, now, that is not fiction in the modern sense. It's a novel. But it's a novel that gives us a confrontation with reality. I know that when I read it in my university days, another student I knew, a philosophy major, a militant atheist, was also reading it. And he was so passionately involved with Raskolnikov, the student murderer, and so convinced that Raskolnikov's thesis was right, that he was thinking as Raskolnikov. He had vicariously killed that old woman with Raskolnikov because he believed it's right and good. We are walking down the street one day discussing some of these ideas after lunch, and we rounded a corner, and there was a cop standing there, and Dick ducked back around the corner. He had so thoroughly identified himself with the murderer, Raskolnikov, that he reacted like a murderer. And he began to swear, and he said, "I'm going to quit reading that book. I'm going to quit reading that book, and I'm getting out of that course," which he did.
Wow. That's pretty powerful. Well,
yes.
I guess the what you were saying, this sense of conscience is a tremendous threat to our desire to put an overly high value on reason and rationality.
The thing that man cannot ever escape, no matter how much he tries, is the fact that he is created in the image of God. And all his being is revelational of God. Everything in man cries out in its witness to God. In several books by men who left the Soviet Union, as well as in conversation with one or two whom I've met, the thing that comes through is that some of these particularly vicious KGB men and prison camp torturers and the like, when they start drinking, their conscience begins to scream out because their self-control goes, and with it their conscience is telling them what they are. Very, very powerful witness.
You know, that's interesting what you just said. It triggered a thought. I think it was in the Freeman some months ago that I read a piece that had to do with the importance of names and how totalitarian states always try to substitute numbers for names. And maybe what they're trying to do, along with that story you told me about the three nuns, is to try to eliminate any obvious aspect or characteristic of man that would be a revelation of his creator. If you strip him of all of these things which speak of God, it's a way of bolstering your own atheism. And again, in my classes, I hadn't recognized this before, I'm beginning to learn about the great importance of names and naming and how God, you know, uses that and works with that. I mean, changed Abraham's name. Jesus changed Matthew's name, and so forth and so on. And in doing that, I guess, along with the thought that I first expressed, there's the further thought that the people who are doing this are trying to substitute themselves for God.
Yes, exactly. And you see, besides trying to eliminate the identifying mark of names, which goes back to Genesis and the fact that God created man in his image and named him.
And that he then gave him the right to name the animals.
Exactly.
Which was an exercise of dominion and control.
Right. So now, with DNA research and the genetic re-engineering of man that they plan to do, they have openly stated in some instances that they are going to be the new gods, that they are going to remake man. So their atheistic insanity is very, very plainly stated.
Well, I think we're, you know, facing threats from a number of directions, and I think just as in military, you have to G2 the opposition. You have to know, you know, what your enemy's capabilities are, his intentions, where he's coming from, what his plans are. And I always use this concept that the world is divided into various groups of people, two of which are those who like to tell other people what to do and those who don't. And I generally fall into the latter category, except when it comes to something like abortion or murder or theft, where I think God has said that you know, man should take measures to control his fellow man for the protection of the innocent. Not even so much for judgment, which is God's, but for the protection of the innocent. And I see these people, some well-meaning, they're just not knowledgeable, they haven't had the good fortune that we might have had to have been raised in a particular way and, you know, learn what we've learned of God's principles. But they have just decided to put their ideas into practice, and the fact that they use force to do that, and the fact that they're pushing other people around and forcing them to conform to their ideas just is not doesn't seem to be important to them. The ends justify the means, and the end, in their view, is a good one, and therefore, who are the victims to complain?
Yes. Well, with this kind of aggressive action all around us, I think we have to let people know that they cannot be armchair Christians.
Right.
They've
absolutely
got to be in the battle. We are in the critical period of all history, I believe, today. We have a worldwide economic crisis looming. We have a worldwide religious confrontation between anti-Christianity and Christianity. We have a worldwide military confrontation perhaps just ahead. We have a worldwide political confrontation as various elitist forces all over the world believe they know better than the rest of us and they're going to rule for us. Mm-hmm. Everywhere you look, you see things coming to a head.
And they've sold us on this relativism concept so that we're put in an inferior position ab initio, where we're afraid to oppose them because we've been told that there is no clear distinction between good and evil, and who are we to say no to them because maybe their ideas are just as good as ours.
Yes.
And I don't mean to be partisan, but just recently I saw George McGovern on television, I think it was the CNN network, and he was saying that we couldn't oppose the communists or try to stand up for good in Central America where they're having these revolutions because we had a revolution of our own. And he didn't seem to see any distinction between a good revolution, such as we had in the United States, and a bad revolution, such as the one in Nicaragua, where the communists took over by force, and talked about right-wing dictatorships in Central America, implying that there was one in El Salvador, and completely ignoring the fact that they had a general election in which the current regime was overwhelmingly voted into office, and the people went to the polls in spite of actual and potential threats of violence and death. So when we can't even see the distinction between good and evil, or where even a how should I say this without being uncharitable, a person associated with the church who is a professor at Harvard Divinity School would go on CBS morning show a few months ago and say that Ronald Reagan was wrong, speaking to the I think National Association of Evangelicals, pointing out that the communist regime in Russia was evil and that it had to be opposed. And this person, I won't name him, was saying that, you know, who can tell what's evil? We have to be charitable and have tolerance for people of different persuasions. I mean, this is the grossest idiocy that I've ever seen. And I noticed that the gentleman who was the co-anchor on the CBS morning show was going overboard to give this fellow plenty of time, to give him leading questions, to take maybe 5 minutes with him, whereas someone with an opposing view, which they didn't even bother to put on, might have gotten 15 or 30 seconds. So it's not even the liberal or leftist bias of the press, I think, that we should be concerned about and try to change, but also their incompetence, because I'm sure that this a particular anchor person just doesn't know of what he speaks and probably hasn't done any studying in this area, even though he gives the appearance and pretends to be knowledgeable enough at least to question the guest.
Mm-hmm. I was interviewed once by a religion editor of a major newspaper who was similarly sure that no one could say what was right and wrong, but a little later he was very sure that Jerry Falwell was all wrong.
Well, that reminds me of the evolutionist. The scientific methodology does prove up the Bible. It doesn't prove up evolution, and yet they stick with evolution and stick with the scientific methodology. And they can't see their own the internal inconsistency of their own position.
Well, John, we're going to have to wind this particular easy chair up now, but I think what we'll do is to continue for another hour and make it our easy chair number 51. and give you an opportunity to go into some other subjects. How people can protect themselves economically, how to prepare for what's coming, because preparation for the future is a must.
Absolutely. I've taught this in my investment seminars, which are entitled Investment Strategy from a Political Perspective, for the last 3 years or so, and I guess, again, maybe it's an old military principle, to be forewarned is to be forearmed.
Yes. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening in, and 2 weeks from now, you'll hear the rest of what we have to say here. Thank you and goodbye.
Authorized by the Chalcedon Foundation. Archived by the Mount Olive Tape Library. Digitized by ChristRules.com.